What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
Go Loud. Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of commercial or passenger vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello and welcome to this, the latest edition of Magnified with Matt Cooper, my podcast series where I get an opportunity to talk to people who might be in business, entertainment, sports, politics, whatever, about their lives, about their careers, about their achievements, about their ambitions, all done with support from Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. You can move your business forward with a fleet of BEV electric vehicles and build your fleet to your expectations by visiting vwfs.ie/business. Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. So my next guest is somebody who has lived the fullest of lives, who I had never met before she came into the studio to record this podcast. And she has a very interesting story to tell us about her son's disability, which she is turning into an ability, about her IVF journey, about the creation of a tech business, which she sold very profitably, about a career in Nashville after she left college and coming back to Ireland to become a physiotherapist, but also getting involved in the establishment of Darkness into Light. And there's so many things that she's done along the way. I can't even go through them all in this introduction, but you'll discover them when you listen to, I forgot about the other one, extreme sports. I mean, when we're talking about extreme sports, we're talking about extreme. We'll get to all of this. Please enjoy Avril Copeland. Recently, after I interviewed Kieran Mulligan, a friend of his said to me, I've got somebody else you have to interview for the Magnified series, Avril Copeland. And I said, who's Avril Copeland? And he told me, and immediately I was really interested in having the opportunity to talk to Avril. And then I did an even bit more research and I was even more interested. So that's why Avril Copeland is our guest on Magnified today. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
All sorts of reasons why I'm really interested in talking to you. I love stories of women in tech building a business and succeeding so that they sell it. That's one point.
Okay.
But I'm also fascinated by your background in Nashville as a young woman and in adventure sports and playing hockey for Ireland. But the adventure sports stuff is what I'm really going to get to because that's a bit extreme. And also how you chose your career in physiotherapy, brought that into tech, but also a little bit about your children. And particularly about your son, Seb. And I don't think I'm prying into anything personal on this because you have written about this on LinkedIn. And I was fascinated by the story of Seb. You're just back from the United States. You brought him there for a particular reason. What was that?
Yeah, so I brought Seb over to a centre called the John Tracy Centre, which is one of the leading kind of diagnostic and education centres in the States for children with hearing loss. So Seb was born profoundly deaf and wears cochlear implants. And I'd heard so much about this centre over the years. And every year they run an international session. So for families all around the world to come over for 2 weeks and essentially learn from them, learn from the best in terms of supporting your child with hearing loss. So yeah, so myself and Seb flew over and we were there for 12 days in total. And Seb took part in a preschool every day. So from like 9 to 2:30, he was you know, in a preschool and with other children who are all kind of deaf, wearing cochlear implants or hearing aids. And then I attended lectures throughout the day. So the lectures comprised of, you know, everything around audiology, hearing loss, you know, your child attending school. There was also support group. There was interaction, you know, with families who are further along in the journey, the hearing loss journey. So kids, teenagers who are doing amazingly well. So we're so inspirational. And yeah, it was just, it was an incredible, incredible 2 weeks.
Tell us about the shock on discovering that Seb had, was born profoundly deaf. How quickly did you find out and how did you find out?
Yeah, so Seb was born the 11th of April, 21. And he was born, you know, it was, you know, after a very long fertility journey of IVF. And he, I think it was the first kind of, you know, day three when he was, when he had arrived, and he had the newborn hearing screen. So I'm not sure if you know, the newborn hearing screen was set up in 2011. And, you know, all children now have this screening test. And he failed that test. But at the time, like, I probably had this false sense of security because I'd been through so much to get to that point. I just thought, like, there's no, I can't worry. I have no more worry left in me. And I just presumed then, you know, that it was. A lot of people had said that this can happen with, you know, babies who are born by C-section. So I kind of put it down to that and didn't think any more about it. And he was brought back in probably about a week later, I'd say. And unfortunately, he failed it again. And I suppose it was at that point I kind of knew, OK, there is something here. I think it was maybe another 2 weeks, he was brought then to the primary care centre in Grange Gorman. So the audiology department there, where he underwent a sedated, it's a special test really to check his brain response to sound. So it's an ABR, it's called an auditory brain response, a brainstem response. And unfortunately he failed that. And I suppose on that day he was diagnosed as he had severe to profound hearing loss in one ear and profound hearing loss in the other. So yeah, it was a massive shock. I think it's like over 90% of babies who are born with hearing loss are born to hearing parents. So I just had no expectation. I worried about everything else that I could possibly worry about. But hearing loss was not something that kind of had come into the equation. So, yeah, it was a tough time.
When a child is born with hearing loss like that, is there anything there to be restored or what can be done for the child to help them to hear?
So it depends really on the cause, and so the type of hearing loss, if it's conductive or, you know, if it's actually to do with a problem with the inner ear, the anatomy. And so in Seb's case, it is to do his malformations in his inner ear, which means that he can't hear through his ears. With babies like that who are born, in some cases, as I said, there is sort of treatments early on, you know, depending on the cause. But in Seb's case, there wasn't. It's essentially you go on. It's a really efficient pathway for kids born with hearing loss here in Ireland. And he was referred on. He had hearing aids, I think, by six weeks of age, like, which was incredible. It was so soon. And while the hearing aids were there, you know, I don't believe he ever had access to speech at that point in time. His hearing loss was just too severe. But he was able to hear really loud sounds. But the idea of the hearing aids was to keep active his auditory nerve, because if he, you know, was going to be deemed a candidate for cochlear implants, it's really vital that auditory nerve is stimulated, you know, until the cochlear implants are in place. So he fortunately was a candidate for cochlear implants, and he got them at, I think, 14 months of age.
What is a cochlear implant and what does it do?
Yeah, so a cochlear implant is essentially an electronic device. So it's made up of two parts. There's an external processor, which essentially looks like a hearing aid. And then there's an internal part. It's an electrode that's put in the snail-shaped kind of structure in your inner ear, the cochlea. And sound is taken in into the processor via a little mic, and then electrical signals are sent to the brain via the auditory nerve. So and represent sound essentially to the brain. So it doesn't restore normal hearing, and it's not the same as normal hearing, but you know it's very, very close. I from what I can tell, but it is a very different type of hearing. So he's had to learn kind of how to detect sound, how to discriminate between sounds, whereas for most of us, you know, it's just kind of a natural, it's kind of organic. But for Seb, he's had to, you know, do a lot of work in terms of detection of sound, discrimination between, you know, if that's a bark or a meow from a cat, essentially. Then to figure out, to identify where that sound is coming from. So, oh, the bark is coming from the dog. But then also to comprehend. So he has to learn about comprehension, which, you know, I suppose is for all kids. So, you know, when the dishwasher beeps, that means we empty the dishwasher, that type of thing. So
there isn't a child in the country who empties the dishwasher. When it
yeah, beeps. That's just know. The idealistic.
I know the idea might be there, might appeal to you as it grows up. But let me warn you, that isn't going to happen. Okay.
I know. Dreams.
So, and what about your voice? How does he hear your voice? Would it be differently to the way that I'm hearing it now and anybody listening to this podcast will hear it?
Yeah, it's so hard to tell, to be honest. It really is hard to tell. And you can, you know, I've looked at forums where there's people who have lost their hearing at a later age and who get cochlear implants, and some report that they hear a very kind of like a Mickey Mouse kind of voice. And then some report that it's actually, you know, brings it back to where, you know, the way they used to hear. So it's really hard to tell, you know, but for Seb, I suppose it's all that he has ever known, and that's all he's ever going to know in a sense, you know, but he's able to discriminate, like if it's me or if my sister-in-law Jane calls on the mobile phone, I put on speaker, he'll know, oh, that's Auntie Jane, or, you know, so it's incredible. Like, it's incredible.
Clearly, you have learned everything about this, which doesn't strike me as surprising, because I think that's probably the type of person you are, that once you dig into a project, you dig in deep. And I suppose project's the wrong way to describe it, but you had an enormous amount to learn. But also, it did suit, I think, perhaps an awful lot of your background in your adult life, didn't it?
Yeah. Like, I don't know, my mom, like, what's next on the agenda now, you know? But yeah, I do tend to kind of focus on one thing and really kind of try and achieve in that area. And then, you know, depend on how that goes, move on to the next thing. So
I'm going to come back to children and IVF a little bit later, if you don't mind, because you've mentioned IVF journey as well.
Yeah.
But I am fascinated in your career as well, because this all happened shortly after you had sold your business as well.
Yeah.
Tell us about the tech business that you set up and why you set it up.
So I worked as a physiotherapist in Beaumont, which was brilliant, and I absolutely loved it. But while I was there, I suppose, it really struck me how, you know, we spend so much time with patients in hospital, and then as soon as they're discharged home, that's kind of it, you know, and that kind of relationship is kind of lost. And so I felt really kind of strongly about that. And I just always thought, God, is there a way to kind of continue that connection between a health professional and patient in a supportive, albeit at a distant way? So during my time in Beaumont, I did research also for the Irish Society of Chartered Physiotherapists around the role of health professionals in prescribing exercise and lifestyle interventions for patients who are living or had, you know, risk factors for chronic diseases. And through that, found that health professionals, you know, are very focused on the time is such the enemy of a health professional, in terms of, you know, they have to get across what they're doing.
And this thing that I read, that you suggested that you might have to focus on, say, something like helping restore a dodgy knee or a hip or something.
But
actually what you should be doing is looking at it as part of the whole body experience, rather than just a single part that you're treating.
Yeah, exactly. And I just felt like there was patients who'd been referred for an arthritic knee or whatever else, and you know, I was doing their exercises, which, you know, as a physio, that's what I'm doing. But also, I suppose I have the education around lifestyle intervention. And, you know, for me, the patient, the more serious problem is that, you know, they're obese or they have high cholesterol, high blood pressure, all those things. And so I wanted to build a technology that would enable me to continue my care of that patient, but provide a personalized program of education and exercise for that patient so that they could go on their way but still get, along with their exercises for, you know, their quads or whatever else, they would get an intervention around their lifestyle to try and prevent, you know, the onset of a chronic condition. So, yeah, it kind of came from that. And I did a pitch here in Dublin a long time ago, and I met a guy, Johnny Walker, Dr. Johnny Walker, who is very well known in the health tech circles. And he was incredible, like a wonderful mentor for me, and took me under his wing kind of for that first year and beyond, and really helped me in terms of build out the business plan, get prepared for funding, all of that good stuff. So, yeah, that's kind of how it started.
Yeah, but you didn't have a tech background to build out the tech, no. Did you? So how did you do that?
No. So the first year I was definitely on my own. I had got some initial funding from Enterprise Ireland, who were a brilliant support throughout. And I, you know, worked with a freelancer who was able to build out a basic prototype. But it did get to a point then where, you know, I needed someone to work with in terms of the technology, obviously being a technology business. So it was amazing that one of my really good friends, her brother, Greg Balmer, had just been part of a company that had been acquired. And Greg was kind of on the lookout for his next challenge. And thankfully, we started talking and I convinced him to come along on the journey with me.
And the name of the company?
The name of the company is Inner Strength.
Inner Strength.
Yeah.
And you then started working, from what I was reading, with people, for example, programs for people with cystic fibrosis.
Yeah. So we started out in the area of cardiovascular disease, both primary prevention and secondary prevention. So for patients that had any type of cardiac event, so supporting them in terms of their rehabilitation. And then I was living in London at the time. We were part of a program with Telefonica in the UK. And I suppose through that time, we applied for a program with the NHS. And thankfully, we were awarded this contract with the NHS to develop a system for children and young people living with cystic fibrosis. So, we worked with researchers at Great Ormond Street, UCL. And we worked with a user research agency over there, and essentially used kind of our foundational platform to build out a solution for the children and young people, which, yeah, that was a brilliant experience.
And how did you develop it further after that?
So we worked on, we were working primarily in the cardiac rehab and then, you know, in that area in cystic fibrosis. And I suppose it was quite soon after that we were on our next kind of phase looking for funding, for Series A funding. And that's when we came across Uniphar PLC, which were the eventual acquirers of the company.
Why did you sell? Because it sounds to me like you found something that you really loved, that there was a purpose in this business, that you didn't set it up to make money, which presumably you did on selling the business.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the purpose, like many entrepreneurs are setting things up because they see the opportunity of an exit.
Yeah, I think, you know, being a startup and going through all that time is, you know, it's a rough road for many. And this, you know, there's lots of smoke and mirrors around startups and everything else. But it is a rough road. And you get to a point where you want to, like, to be able to actually expand at a much more accelerated pace. You have to, not you don't have to, but it does help when you partner with a bigger organization. And we met the chief commercial officer at the time, Pádraig Dempsey, who really had such exciting plans for what they were doing. And our technology seemed to just really fit the bill in terms of supporting what they were doing, but also how that would support what we were doing. So it kind of was a no-brainer at the time for us. It just felt like the right thing to do. And so thankfully it worked out really well.
Will you do it again? Will you set up in business again?
I don't know.
It was a few years though. Was it 2020 you did the sale?
Yeah, 2020, but we continued on until last November.
Okay, so you've only just recently left.
Yeah, so yeah, look, I'm actively kind of looking at the moment. I've had a good few really interesting conversations, both with startups, but also with larger organizations. But yeah, it's just about finding the next challenge, but something that's really on mission in a sense, do you know, something that like I'm really passionate about. That's kind of the most
important.
How
challenging was it as well over the last few years to be dealing with all of this and also to be dealing with Seb's situation?
Yeah, it was hard. I'm not going to lie. It was really hard. I have a great support system, you know, in my family and my friends and, you know, had great childminder, Kim and Dev. So, yeah, like I've had great support, which has allowed me, I suppose, to continue on and obviously get to up to last November, which worked out well.
Now, I'm going to take you back and tell me about Nashville, the home of country music in the United States. What brought you there and how many years did you spend there doing what?
So Nashville came out of essentially when I was probably around 15, 16 in the 90s. I'll tell you how it essentially began from this. I was watching TV and I came across the Lonesome Pine specials, which was a program on Channel 4, which was country music essentially. And whatever, it just struck a chord at me. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. And then like a week later, I saw Garth Brooks' show on Channel 4. And I was like, oh my God, this is like, I don't know what came over me. And I was like, this is amazing. And so I pleaded with my parents to get a satellite dish at the time, a big ugly satellite dish on the side of the house, so I could access the country music television, CMTV at the time. And it was from that then.
So you were indulged. Were you the youngest daughter in the house?
No, middle child. So
and they indulged you in
that? Yeah. Well, after a lot of pleading, they did.
The siblings probably wanted things like the Sky Sports off the satellite
I know, yeah. Like who, you know, whatever, 15, 16 years of age looking for country music television. But yeah, it was just, it all really started from that. I was big into singing at the time. So like, I suppose that all played a role in it. I love music in a sense. So yeah, so when I left school, I had two kind of tracks. One was around physio exercise science, which I was really passionate about because I was playing a lot of hockey at the time. But I also knew my chance of getting the points for something like physio were going to be, you know, it was going to be difficult. And so my kind of second on the list was media production and sound engineering, all with, I suppose, the dream of maybe one day going to Nashville and working in the business. So thankfully, the second worked out. So I went to DIT, studied media production, did sound engineering and went to Nashville just as I'd turned 21. And
just arrived without knowing.
I had been like, you know, feverishly faxing my CV to all these recording studios in Nashville. And I had
faxing,
one.
That's a
yeah, I know. Isn't it?
Yeah.
I know. It's funny thinking about that. And thankfully, one of the recording studios sort of took me on board and as a sound engineering assistant. And I got my visa, moved over there and thinking I'd like everyone going abroad, think they're going to be there for a year. I ended up there for 7 years.
7 years in Nashville. Yeah, what did you do? Yeah. I mean, were you working in the studio the whole time?
Yeah. So the first year I was in a recording studio called the Sound Emporium, which is, you know, near Music Row. And all the big kind of singers, big albums had been, you know, were being made within this recording studio. So that was super exciting from day one. Just like every week, it's like, who's coming in this week? Loads. Like the first day, I think it was like Jamie O'Neill singing. She was a big country artist at the time, but, you know, the Bridget Jones, there's this All By Myself, the Celine Dion song. So she was recording that for the Bridget Jones soundtrack that first day. Like T-Bone Burnett, Trish Yearwood, all these people. Like,
these are big
wigs.
Stars.
Yeah, big wigs. So
Garth Brooks ever turn up?
He didn't turn up, but I'll tell you a funny story when I was there. So my first year in the recording studio, second, I then got offered a job with one of the big songwriters at the time, Annie Roboff, who was writing for like the Faith Hill, Trish Yearwood, all these people as well, Martina McBride. And Annie's friend was a songwriter too called Beth Nielsen Chapman. And so I did tour management for Beth. And one Christmas she said, oh, like, do you want to come to this gig in Opryland, I think it was. And I was like, oh, this would be great. And Vince Gill was there. And it turns out Garth Brooks was there. And And then that night they were like, oh, do you want to come for dinner? And I ended up going for dinner with Garth Brooks and Tricia Yearwood. So it kind of came full circle.
So they said, go meet your heroes.
Yeah.
This worked out when you met your heroes?
Well, no, it did. Like, it's like, actually, when I had attended his first concert back in 93 in The Point, like, the only person I could get to go was Dad. And, you know, it was like, I suppose, everyone now with Taylor Swift. Like, he was that important to me.
I was at that gig, I think.
Were you?
Everybody was using their cigarette lighters inside the days before mobile phones to light up The Point.
I know. And actually, in Dad's wisdom, at the end, you remember at The Point, like, to get out before all the traffic, Dad's like, oh, we leave before the last song. And just as we were leaving, he'd obviously finished his last song and the bus kind of came out. We were stopped and the bus came out. And I was like, oh my God, there's Garth Brooks on the bus, you know. And so Dad, two of us jumped in the car, literally followed him back to the Berkeley Court. And I ran into the Berkeley Court and I remember seeing this hat go up in the lift, you know. And I was like, oh my God, I couldn't believe I'd missed him. And then next thing, this arm comes around my shoulders and it was him. So, you know, I obviously never told him that story when I met him.
I was just,
he bought me dinner.
You don't remember me to be back in Dublin.
He following you through, you know, Dublin. Oh, Lord. But Nashville was, it was incredible. But I worked for Annie then for 4 years. And, you know, I was doing the music, you know, music business. But I also then decided I would return to college over there and study exercise science, which I did in Belmont University. So I got my degree in exercise science, which then led me back home in a sense.
Okay, but before you went, you also had a very promising hockey career. How far did that career go for you?
So, yeah, I played Leinster. I started kind of with Leinster under 16 and then Irish under 18, Irish under 21. And I just made the senior panel, the Irish senior panel, before I moved to Nashville. And we had, it was around the time of the Sydney Olympics and Ireland didn't qualify. And so, to be honest, I'd probably made my mind up anyway. I, you know, the opportunity for Nashville had come about. And so I ended up, moving to Nashville and that kind of.
Any regrets that you didn't go and play out a senior international hockey career?
No, I loved it and it was, but you know, I had played a long time. Like I was playing club, you know, when I was in school, I was playing school, club, Leinster, Irish, you know, so it was a lot of hockey for a long time. So I did, like you were saying earlier, it's kind of like I've kind of done that, what's next, you know.
But then extreme sports.
Yeah.
Now tell us, is that the term that you use for it, or what you call it?
Yeah, adventure racing or expedition adventure racing. So that was kind of my next big thing.
Okay, and you better explain to people, because you know, I've interviewed on Magnified somebody who's climbed Mount Everest, in fairness.
Yeah.
And that's pretty extreme
that
as well,
extreme,
okay?
Yeah.
And who does things like ultramarathons or whatever as well.
Yeah.
But tell us what's involved in the sports that you've chosen.
So adventure racing, like I came about adventure racing because it was my first year in Nashville and I was home for Christmas and I was watching TV and I came across
TV,
I do, I know it sounds, I don't know, I'm selling myself here. I came across the Eco Challenge, which was a huge kind of race in around the mid 90s. And Mark Burnett, you know, who's now
the
famous
Apprentice.
Survivor, The Apprentice. He had taken adventure racing and kind of brought it to, you know, the main stage in a sense, like televised it. And so it became a huge thing in the States around the time I had moved to Nashville. Adventure racing, it's a multidisciplinary sport. So where a co-ed team of four have to navigate their way over an unmarked course. So using map and compass the whole way, you have to, navigate from checkpoint to checkpoint and get them all in order and then get to the finish line. So
a combination of running, cycling, kayaking,
exactly.
Climbing.
Yeah. So the main disciplines, are trekking, paddling. So be it kayaking, canoeing, whitewater swimming we did in one race, mountain biking, climbing. Yeah, like there's core disciplines, but then dependent on the race and the location. So in one of the races we did horse riding, you know, it started out with a big kind of, I don't know what it was, but we started out on horseback for the first kind of day.
A day?
Yeah.
And had you any previous experience in that?
Yeah, to be fair, I had, growing up, I had done some horse riding. So, that was like that race was 900 kilometres long over, I think it took us 9 days, 8 to 9 days.
How much sleep?
So in adventure racing, like the goal is, you know, you're racing against whatever 60, 70 other teams. And the goal is to get from start to finish, pick up all the checkpoints in order, as fast as you can. So normally teams will maybe forgo sleep the first night, and then it could be 2-3 hours a night then after. So
you've got to use judgment a lot of the times as to risk, as to what's safe to do or what.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're doing it on that little sleep.
Yeah, it is. It can be like it is, you know, while it is a race, like you are out there in Mother Nature. Like in the last race, we were in Ecuador, over the Andes, the Amazon rainforest, and you're out there on your own. You take that risk yourself. And so the sleep deprivation does play a big role. So you really have to, you have to work as a team. And
is it true in that race in Ecuador, one of your teammates was infected by a parasite and became extremely ill?
Yeah, he did.
This was your navigator.
Yeah, he did. It was touch and go for a while in terms of whether we were going to continue with the race. He was, in bits, to be fair. It was tough. We were trying to help, you know, and that's the whole thing with adventure racing. It is such a team sport. So if one person pulls out, then the whole team is, you know, they can continue on unofficially, but the race is over essentially for the whole team. So you really do everything you can to try and support everyone reach the finish line together. So, it's a lot of, you know, towing people. You know, this everyone has like little tow ropes set up on their bikes or on their their packs or even on their kayaks. You're carrying people's packs with all their gear and just to try and get them to the next checkpoint where they can get a rest.
What's the attraction of this sport?
I know it does. When I describe it, I'm like, God, people wonder, but it's just incredible. Like it's really hard to describe, to be fair. Like you're out there, you're seeing these sunsets which you feel like no one's ever seen. Like you're in these
you've
incredible
tried to see these sunsets given that I get the impression you're just constantly moving.
Yeah, like it's just an incredible, like the places that you see just untouched. And it's the teamwork, like it's just the camaraderie of the team. Even with other teams, like you're helping other teams. You're like, oh, look, I'm stuck. We can't find this next checkpoint. And so you'll work together to get that next checkpoint or whatever that may be. So it's just the teamwork. It's just an incredible, it's really hard to describe.
Okay, but tell us about the injuries that you suffered in doing this.
Yeah, so I had, that first, the horse riding one was in Primal Quest, Utah, and that was across the desert, and it hit like, I think, 120 degrees, like at one point in the desert, you know. But I fractured.
So you need a camel rather than a horse for that.
Yeah. So that day, actually the very first day, while I say I had experienced horse riding, I actually got thrown off the horse the first morning and fractured my sacrum, which is, you know, the bottom of your spine. But
you fractured the bottom of your spine. So that put an end to that race?
No, actually, I didn't realise. Like it was a stable fracture. So it wasn't until I got back to Nashville and I went for x-rays and all that we realised it. Another race, I fractured my elbow. And again, didn't realise till I got back. But then one, I'd fractured my ankle, and that was an end of the race for me.
And another one, you got a splinter in your eye?
I got a splinter in my eye.
And still kept going?
Still kept going, yeah. And I got pneumonia in another race in Montana.
And kept going?
Yeah. But again, it's like all your teammates. It's not, you know, that way you just like, when I had the pneumonia now, it was really rough because I couldn't put any effort in. I was just out of breath. So all my teammates just rallied around and kind of got me to the next checkpoint. And I was able to get, you know, there's medical tents at different transition areas. So I was able to kind of get help. And
how many of these races did you do?
I did a lot of the expedition races, and I did a few world championships within that. So it was over like 14-year period. So it was
But yeah, you stopped it, have you?
Yeah, well, I've come to the point now. I don't know that I'll ever get back doing expedition racing, but...
What are you doing as an alternative? Because you strike me as somebody who needs something.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm trying to be fair now with the kids, like, full on. So I am trying to get back now, get back running and kind of get back into the... Yeah, get back into running. That's kind of my
next
thing.
Came back to Ireland. What was it like coming back to Ireland after so long away?
It was definitely a bit of a transition initially, like having lived, you know, like the States is very different in many ways. And yeah, it was a bit of a transition, but I suppose I came home to something. I had got into the Royal College of Surgeons to do physio. So I was coming home to do that. So I had a very specific thing that I was coming home to. And that kept me busy, to be fair, for the few years, the 3 years that I was there.
And you had... wanted to be a physio when you were in school, didn't have the points,
yeah.
Came back to, what is it about that as a particular job that you attracted, and how long did you do it for, and how much did you get out of it when you did it?
Yeah, like, I'd want to do physio really because I suppose all the sports that I was playing and I, you know, had got involved with, or had like plenty of physio, you know, during my hockey career. So yeah, I'd always wanted to do it. And then, yeah, I loved it. I worked in Beaumont. I worked in outpatients, oncology, and I loved the actual work, but I also loved the people, to be honest. Especially in Beaumont, you know, there's quite, you know, if you're in oncology or the different areas, like you're meeting people at a really vulnerable time in their life. So you're doing your physio, but you're also, I suppose, connecting with these people. And I really did feel like it was a privilege to kind of spend time with people, and especially people who potentially only had a few weeks or a few days to live. Like, it was just, I don't know, it was really real. I don't know how, that's the only way to describe it.
You were also involved in setting up the Darkness into Light run for the Pieta House. Tell us how you got involved in that and why.
Yeah, so when that was 2009 was our first one. So when I came home from Nashville, I obviously had been very involved in sport and everything else. And Joan Freeman, who was head of Pieta at the time and founder of Pieta, Joan had this idea and was looking to form a committee to implement the idea. And thankfully, a friend of mine who was a teacher out in Llandochan and who had used the services, you know, for some of the kids, she asked me to be part of it. She just said, look, we're putting on this 5K and we need, you know, we need to round out the team with people who have experience with kind of racing and all that good stuff. So yeah, thankfully they asked me, and yeah, it's incredible what it's become.
Well, it's developed into something different really, hasn't it? In the sense that it is more almost maybe spiritual is not necessarily an exaggeration, but I think yeah. People get involved in it not because of the physical exercise,
yeah. Yeah.
But they get into it, this whole idea of being out and about at daybreak and to be involved in a physical activity at the time. I know people who go kayaking on
yeah.
the sea,
yeah.
for example, or do various sort of things, a walk or a run, but just that idea of being alive to do something as the dawn breaks.
Yeah, I think that was always the intention somewhat. You know, the 5K, I suppose, was just a way of bringing people together. Yeah, it's like a movement. It really has become that. And I think for Joan, anyway, setting it up, it really was about the awareness and trying to build awareness around mental health and suicide and self-harm. So I think she's definitely achieved that with Darkness into Light.
Now, you mentioned earlier, and again, it's a private issue, but you have mentioned it, which is why I'm asking you about it, which is your IVF experience, which is something that a lot of women have gone through in Ireland and perhaps haven't spoken very much about, because it can be a very difficult and lonely place, can't it? How long did you go through IVF for, and why did you decide to go that route in the first place?
Yeah, so I'm a single parent, so I decided to go it alone. I got to a point... like many others, you know, you get to an age and you decide, okay, well, look, if you really want kids, then this is the option, in a sense.
Yeah.
So I decided, yeah, I would go it alone, and made the decision back in 2018. And
big decision to go it alone.
Yeah, it was a big decision. It was a big decision. But I think it's just that innate kind of need or want to have children. And it's just something you can't, I suppose, push back down. So I decided I would do it. I had my first kind of clinic appointment in May 2018. And then Seb was born April 21.
Okay. So that's a few years.
It was a solid, like, between May 18 and August 2020, I had done like 3 rounds of IVF and 5 embryo transfers. So it was kind of back to back for a few years there.
And these didn't work for you?
Yeah, yeah. So I started, in all intents and purposes, like in terms of the stats, it probably should have worked, some of the transfers, because I had done embryo testing and things like that, which had meant there was a greater likelihood of success with certain embryos which were chosen. And unfortunately, you know, with the clinic I was with in Dublin, they just couldn't figure out why I wasn't able to carry and, you know, have an ongoing pregnancy. So back in 2020, I decided, like during COVID times, I decided, well, I was going to go to a clinic in London, who is kind of seen as the last chance saloon in a sense. And so I went over there in August 2020. And thankfully, they just had the right recipe and it worked.
How much resilience do you need in a situation like that? And particularly when you're doing it on your own, because an awful lot of, for a lot of women, they're part of a couple at a time when they're going through IVF. So that if things go wrong, I suppose there's a shared experience that people can rely upon each other. What's it like when you're doing it on your own?
It's really hard. Like, I had been through all the adventure racing and I thought I was resilient, to be fair, you know, and I went into this thinking like, 1 + 1 = 2. And I just thought, you know, you put the work in and it'll happen. But unfortunately, there's no guarantees with fertility treatment. And I think that was the hardest thing for me, was just knowing that all the work I was putting in, all the time, effort, money, you know, there was never any guarantee that actually this would be successful. So it definitely has been the hardest thing I've ever gone through. And it is probably, well, maybe it is easier, maybe it isn't easier going through it with a couple, as a couple. But, you know, like, I wasn't, and I had an incredible support system around me. So like my GP just here over the road, Dr. O'Neill, like, she had been through all the, even the decision making process when I was trying to decide what to do. And then the whole way through all the early miscarriages and everything. And then, you know, Kathy Allen, who's a professor in Hollow Street, and she was head of the recurrent miscarriage clinic and the TLC clinic. So she had the experience and knew everything that I was going through, so offered me incredible reassurance throughout the whole process. And then obviously my family and friends were just stellar, and they all helped me through it. And, you know, I think everyone just experienced the joy and delight when Seb was finally born.
And then you decided to do it again.
Yeah, madly enough. I suppose it was just an incredible experience. Like, the pregnancy was really difficult, I'm not going to lie. After the years of early losses, I think pregnancy after loss, it's, you know, it's not about, you know, when, if it's going to happen, like in terms of loss, you kind of get in that mindset. It's like, when? So like the first 6 months, I was like terrified to move. I was every time I get off the couch or out of bed, I was like,
that must have been very difficult for you, given that you're clearly a highly active person.
Yeah, it was. But I was just like, I was doing everything to protect this pregnancy, you know, even though it was totally out of my control. I just had to, for my own kind of control issues, I felt like I just had to be so careful. And so it wasn't really till I was about 6 months pregnant that I like told my friends, my close friends didn't even know till I was about, it was a bit further, like 29 weeks. Like, some of my really close friends knew, but like my wider group of friends, I didn't tell them because I was just so fearful. And it was kind of maybe when I got to like 26, 29 weeks, I thought, God, actually, this might work, you know. But up until that point, it was difficult.
But I am interested as well that given what you knew quickly about Seb and you knew that you would have to do to help him, that you decided to go through IVF again to have another child.
Yeah.
And that's a sort of a brave decision.
Yeah, I just previous to all the challenges when it came to the fertility treatment, I had always wanted to. I always thought, like, I'd you know, I would love to have two children. And when Seb was born, like, you know, with the deafness and everything else, like, I did, you know, for him, like, I want another baby, I'm not going to lie, yeah. You know, and but I also thought for him it would be brilliant to have someone else as well. So so thankfully, and even at that, I thought, like, I had a few embryos left, but I didn't think it was even going to happen.
But were you not fearful of something like another child might be born with deafness or some other condition that you had no control over what would happen?
Yeah, I did. I worried again throughout this pregnancy, but I suppose I had lots of reassurance from everyone around me, you know, and I had done all the testing and everything else. So, I had talked to actually one of the doctors in Hollis Street, and she's like, if everyone thought about every possibility that could happen with having a child, no one would have children, you know. And I just thought, that's exactly it, you know. And it's, I suppose we all never know. And while Seb, there's a famous kind of poem that people who have children who may have additional needs, it's called Welcome to Holland. And many parents who have children with different conditions, I'm sure, have heard of this. It's like a poem or a story. But it's about...
Would you tell it? Because I read it after I saw you blogged about it.
Yeah.
And it actually is really... Oh, yes. Okay, that makes sense. So just tell our listeners a little bit about it.
Yeah, I don't know it off by heart now.
Well, not off by heart, but
it owns them. Yeah, so it's basically... Emily Pearl Kingsley is a famous American author, and she actually was a writer for Sesame Street. And she had a child, her son was born with Down syndrome. And she was often asked about, you know, what it's like to raise a child with Down syndrome. And so she decided to write this piece about raising a child with additional needs. And it essentially likens a, you know, having a child and raising a child, you know, a typical child, to a trip, like an amazing trip to Italy, and that of raising a child with additional needs, a trip to Holland. And the whole premise is that, you know, when you're pregnant and, you know, all your friends have been on this exciting journey to Italy and are now living in Italy, and it's so wonderful, Italy, and everyone prepares to go to Italy. And so you think when you're pregnant, you are on your way to Italy and that's it. You get all the guidebooks, you talk to loads of people, get recommendations, and Italy is where you're going to go and where you're going to stay. But when the plane touches down, the attendant comes on and says, "Welcome to Holland." And you're like, what? You know, like, I'm going to Italy. Like, what's Holland? I was all planned. I had all the guidebooks. I'd spent 8 months planning to go to Italy. So it's the shock of, you know, arriving somewhere completely different. And a friend of mine had sent me this kind of piece when I was kind of in a bit of a hole. Like, it was a big shock with Seb and his hearing loss. And she sent it to me, and it really just totally changed my perspective on everything. And it was basically saying that, it's a bit emotional actually, but it was basically saying that, you know, even though you've gone to a different place, it's not a dingy, horrible place. It's actually a beautiful place, but it's just somewhere different, you know. And she advises people that are reading it to, like, you know, don't spend all your life mourning the fact that you didn't go to Italy, because if you do, you'll miss all the wonderful things about Holland. So, yeah, it's so true, you know, like, I wouldn't change Seb for the world now, you know, so.
And is there a little brother or sister to Seb?
Little brother, Ted, little Teddy. He's a bulldozer. He is night and day. Where Seb was very chilled out baby, Ted is the opposite. He is a little live wire.
And all good with him health-wise?
Oh, he's brilliant. He's great. And they get on great, thankfully, as well, so far.
So what's the future for Seb going to be like, do you reckon?
So, like, I have every expectation, and I think all the professionals do, that he will live a very normal life.
He'll just go to normal school like everyone else.
Yeah, mainstream, yeah. And will, you know, he'll need extra supports in terms of technology, you know, amplification in the classroom and things like that. But, like, even seeing these children at the John Tracy Centre, like, there was, you know, even a younger adult came in and he's about to start on his doctorate in psychology. And yeah, so I have all the expectations, as I do for Seb, as I do for Ted. So, yeah.
And what about your own expectations for yourself now?
So, yeah, it's just, as I said earlier, just kind of figuring out what the next step is or what the next mission is. I just really want to find something. Everything I've ever done has been I've just had this kind of deep-seated passion or want to do something. And so I'm really trying to find what that next thing is.
And then you'll throw yourself into it.
Exactly.
Will you?
Yeah.
Well, one thing to finish, you mentioned your dad a number of times, and I deliberately didn't mention him up until now because you're your own person.
Yeah.
But he is very, very well known because he's Louis Copeland, the tailor, who has been very high-profile businessman over the years. And you were never tempted, were you, into his line of work? Or would you find that a little bit dull, maybe?
Yeah, potentially. It never was something that I wanted to get into. My brother, Louis, is brilliant and, you know, is practically run the show with my dad. If not, he is running the show with my dad. So Louis is well established in there and doing a brilliant job. Myself and my sister, Rachel, Rachel did get in. Rachel was working in one of the stores in Dundrum. I never kind of had the want or to be part of it.
You went to Holland and said
I went to Holland and exactly.
Avril, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Magnified. It's been great meeting you.
Thank you, and you. Thank you.
So that's it for today's Magnified with Matt Cooper. I hope you enjoyed it. There are loads of other interviews from the series that you can go back to and listen to if you liked this one. For example, and I mentioned it at the start with Avril, Kieran Mulligan was somebody that I had earlier on in the series, and you might enjoy his personal story, and there are many others as well. So if you do like the series, please recommend it to a friend wherever it is you're listening to it, be it Apple, Spotify, or on the Go Loud app. So until the next time, from me, Matt Cooper, thank you for listening. And again, thanks to our sponsors here at Volkswagen Financial Service Business Leasing. If you're looking to upgrade your business fleet, well, then you can choose from a wide range of vehicles local to you. Visit vwfs.ie/business. And Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Until the next time, I'm Magnified. Thanks for listening.
Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Looking to upgrade your business fleet? Choose from a wide range of vehicles local to you. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.